Just slide that in the pocket, you're good to go, or get it out of your way, and wherever.
And it's already started.
You're good to go.
Thank you, sir.
Well, hello there. We weeded our garden, didn't we? It's going to Africa.
Danny, that's right. He went all the way to Africa.
Okie dokie. I have always thought that some of the things that I really think matters that other people think, no, they don't. I'll go somewhere else. Go right ahead. I don't get paid by the student anyway. This is my contract. I just show up. I did a little thinking about some of these baseball contracts. I've done a lot of thinking about baseball contracts. And I looked up Lou Gehrig's statistics in his last complete season, which he was actually already suffering the disease, but they didn't know it. It wasn't diagnosed. And so that whatever year that was, 38 or something like that, he was showing symptoms at the end of the year at least, but he didn't miss any games. And he started the next season and played a little while, and then in May the 2nd in Detroit, he pulled himself from the lineup and almost immediately was diagnosed with the disease that has now got his name, Lou Gehrig's disease. But anyway, his last season before that, when he was already sick, I looked at his statistics the other day and compared them to Manny Machado and Bryce Harper, who are both supposedly going to get $300 million before they bat. And his statistics when he was dying were as good as or better than any year that either one of these guys has ever had yet. And it was his worst year ever, by far. And I think it's just amazing to me the difference. And then you start thinking, okay, if you make $30 million this year as a baseball player, which is like $50,000 per at-bat, no matter what you do when you walk up to the plate, you know, you're going to get a check at the dugout. I thought about what would it take if you made $100,000 a year? How many years would that take just to make 1 year's worth, $30 million? Well, it's a lot. A lot longer than any of us will ever live. And it just kind of puts perspective into how much money they make. And when I hear someone say, he's worth every penny, I think, no, he's not. No, I don't think so. But anyway, that was some of the stuff I thought about this week. Our book tonight is Mark, and I do want to go through the outline some, and then I want to look at the little PowerPoint sheet, and then I have some other notes, which I don't know how much of it we'll get to, but it is the shortest book. And it is the shortest book because of what's left out. Not what's in the book is also a lot of it in Matthew and Luke, and sometimes longer in Mark, a lot of these stories that he tells. But if you look at Matthew chapter 1 to 7, almost none of that is anywhere else, except a few statements about the temptation in the wilderness and the work of John. The stories of the birth of Jesus are totally different in Matthew and Luke, and they aren't anywhere else. And Matthew has a Sermon on the Mount. So in Matthew 8, you have connections with Mark 1. In Matthew 9, Mark 2. And to some degree, that parallel continues through Mark's record, except for the places where Matthew has one of Jesus' speeches, where Mark either will eliminate it or really make it brief. So the outline kind of shows that. The outline that I have on Mark, Jesus the Servant, again, this title is one that that I picked from listening to somebody else, because they talked about how Mark is a book of action. Jesus is constantly doing or going in Mark. We don't have the long sermons or speeches like we do in Matthew and really in John, more of the long sort of talk or interaction and speech about themes that are not anywhere else. But Mark does a lot of reporting of Jesus moving about, and he is spoken of in Mark as the Son of Man. Nobody else calls him that. And I want to get to that as part of our supplementary stuff here in a little while. And that indicates the humanity, the servanthood of Jesus. And if you look at the outline where it says Roman numeral 2, the servant's ministry, notice that in last week in Matthew, the outline was activity, speech, activity, speech. Well, this is not that. There aren't any long speeches. There are a couple places, like in chapter 4, where he deals with some of the parables that Jesus had in Matthew 13, if you see the connection in the timeline. But most of them he doesn't talk about, and then Mark 4 is a lot shorter than Matthew 13. Most of the time, these are just events. Jesus in a person, Jesus in a group, Jesus doing certain miracles or conversations. So the servant's ministry, all I have under that is A and B. And you have A in Galilee, and then B in the final circuit. And if you study the life of Christ, you know that that's not all he did, and he didn't only go there. He went to other places. But Mark is just honing in on the activity in these two groups of things. So in Galilee, I have it divided into 11 sections, which is still more than I like, but that seems to be the way it's structured. So in the beginning, he gains followers, and I have ways. And I think this is an application here. If we're going to gain followers for Christ, we have to know that the way we do that is multiple ways of doing that. So he calls fishermen. If you are, if you have a hobby that involves a lot of people who have the same likes, or a job, you know, you can connect with people through that thing. Jesus connected with fishermen and talked about that with them, and that led to, I'll make you fishers of men, as he said in Matthew. By teaching, by casting out a demon, I would think that would be easy to make some contacts if you cast a demon out, you know, which we can't do because we don't have any to cast out, but we can touch people's lives in very serious situations and develop some sort of a connection there, and who knows which person in that group is going to be the one that we might connect with as far as the gospel is concerned. And I think it's frustrating. I mean, I can let that out a little bit, but I, for all these years of preaching funerals, for example, I'm always hoping that something, and my sermon, my funerals are very short, might somewhere connect up with somebody in the audience, in that they might respond by wanting more, which I don't know that that's ever happened yet, but that's the effort we make, is to sit, look at the setting, what sort of situation is this, and how can I be a part of it, and then look for results. So healing Simon's mother-in-law, which is brought up in the other accounts as well, gave him another opportunity. All these things also gave him the opportunity of being attacked, which I want to address also on the little PowerPoint thing, the chart. And then by healing, praying, understanding his mission. That is, he understands his mission and he wants others to, which is pretty important that we know what we're about if we're going to be servants, which is, I think, one of the points Mark wants us to get, is that he expects us to be servants. Then we need to understand that. What does it mean to be a servant? Am I going to be the foot washer or the one who expects you to wash my feet? You know, and I saw that in India, where I saw in the first trip I went on a long time ago. All of us were new to that. Keith Ball went, and I forget who else went that you would have known, but Keith was one you would have known. And I saw us thinking that we're here to help you, which we are. But if we don't sit down and let somebody wash our feet, if we don't let somebody help us, then we're doing a one-directional approach. And I think we need to understand our mission is to be helped as well, and to be made stronger as a result of our effort and our journey and that kind of thing. And so Jesus understood his mission. We need to get a handle on what we're supposed to be. So that's under number one. Number two, he works miracles of healing. You have the leper, the paralyzed man who's let down through the roof, remember, on his bed. I brought with me tonight what's called an interlinear. You probably already know what an interlinear is, but this is a one of a kind, a unique format. It has it's a five-line interlinear. The top line is the English, and it's an interlinear where the English is in reading order. Usually it's not. Usually the interlinear has the Greek in the Greek order, and the English is not in reading order. So they took, this is the ESV, they did that, then they have the Greek, and then they have different things about it, the transliteration, and then what part of speech it is, and then what number it is in Strong's. It's all in a column. And I brought that because I want to use it in some of the points we're going to make in a minute. But when you read through this, if you had a chance to get an interlinear, this would be a good one, because it immediately connects to Strong's and others, which you don't have to carry all that with you. You see some powerful and interesting terms that you can connect up with helping people, as far as maybe piquing their interest in various things that they might want to know about, or might say, well, that's interesting, and then they're wanting to know maybe a little bit more about the life of Christ just because of a term, a word that you learned and decided to communicate to them. And then number three, calls and defends disciples. Levi is, of course, Matthew. He defends his own methods. He defends his disciples. So he's already being, this is early in Mark. It's not necessarily early in the whole chronology of his work, but it is early in Mark, and he's already going to be attacked. Chapter 3, silences adversaries, and I'm going to read some verses from that in a little bit. He calls 12, accused again. Notice all this is happening, and we're still not out of chapter 3, and he's already meeting up with all sorts of opposition. And that goes with the theme on the other chart, they wanted him dead. You know, in Matthew, they wanted him dead when he was a baby. Well, we don't meet him as a baby in Mark, but as soon as he appears in public, he begins to be attacked. And they're looking for something that they can use against him now, and they continue to look, and they never find anything, even to the trial where they're still looking for witnesses, somebody to make a case against this man. So that's already building up. Number seven, the parables. Compare that with the parable outline from Matthew 13. You see that this one leaves some of those out, most of them, as a matter of fact. And it's shorter, but it is probably the longest speech in Mark, at least the first part of it. And then more miracles. Number eight, the calming of the sea, casting legion out with the demons. And then here's an interesting thing that I think is all the writers deal with this, I think, except John. The daughter of Jairus and the woman with the issue of blood. It's two stories running together. You know, we see that a lot today in TV and movies. But here, instead of just giving a whole thing, Mark interweaves these two things, and so you can't make one point out of it because it's two stories at once, and it's a really powerful story about how he was able to reach into both of these families and give them what they needed, and then so forth. I'm not going to read all the rest of this, but you can see what's happening, that it's all about action and movement from place to place, family to family, house to house, and providing in every case the thing they needed the most, whether they knew that at first or not. Then on the backside, B, the final circuit, already in Mark 7, not even halfway through the book, we are approaching the end of his life. Luke has Jesus setting his face steadfastly to go to Jerusalem in Luke 9. That's really early in the book for us to already be that close to the end of his life. But that's really what these books are headed toward, is that huge amount of material for the last part of his life. So in this final circuit, we're able to get a little bit more of the movement with the map. So you have north, the Syrophoenician woman, and then east toward Decapolis on the other side of the Jordan, and then three near Caesarea Philippi, and through Galilee, number four, Capernaum, east of Jordan. So he's going back and forth, and then toward Jerusalem at the end of number seven down there at the bottom is chapter 10. Comes to a close. You have all of this, but it's still all action, movement, Son of Man, servant of God, and servant of man. And so you have a lot of incidents that you could bring up and talk to people about and just become familiar with the way the book reads. So if you have, and a lot of people are more interested in this kind of thing than maybe the sermon, and I think I'm the other way. I would prefer the Matthew or John over the Mark approach as far as what I think my personality is like. But apparently God knew that you can imagine when these books first came out that for quite a while a person who might have known about Mark may have never heard of Matthew, Luke, or John, and maybe they never did. So, and that's one way to read these books, is as if you don't know anything about the other ones. Mark McGarvey's fourfold gospel is, I think, one of the greatest ideas anybody ever had, to put them all together and try to get them in chronological order, as well as tying these stories that in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they all sound alike, but when you actually look at Matthew's account and Mark and Luke of the same event, they're not word for word. So they supplement one another. They explain one another. So that approach of McGarvey has a lot of value to it. But still, whoever got the book of Mark first may well have never seen the other one. So how did they take it? How do you do Mark just by itself? Well, it shouldn't be too hard to do that and just not even try to connect with the other ones sometimes. And some people need that approach that Mark has without having all the other brought into it, because this is the kind of a report of a person's life that would appeal to a lot of people, besides the fact that it's so short. You can get through it pretty fast if you wanted to. So you have all of that, but then like the rest of them and all of the Old Testament prophets, we come to the servant's suffering, 11:1, 15:47. So we have all those chapters there, five in a row, that are all about the very end of Jesus' life, that last week. And again, it's not real easy to maybe conclude perfectly what day each thing happened on, because it looks like one day of that week, nothing happened because there's no record of what most people think of as Wednesday. There's nothing. Tuesday, from my look at it, is about as full a report of any day of Jesus' life that there is, except the last one. It is just, it is really packed. And but it begins, we think, with Sunday, with this entrance into the city. And so you have a lot of information under point A. He teaches in Jerusalem. And the teaching here, even, except for chapter 13, a lot of it is very short little lessons, or answering questions, or dealing with some accusation, or giving instructions. So we've dealt with that outline on number one with that idea in mind. At what situations can instruction take place? Well, virtually any situation. So two disciples, he even talks to a fig tree. Not that the fig tree can understand, but people are watching. People are listening. So there is a way to even make a contact, touch somebody, reach somebody by talking about or a subject that is, why would they do that? And all of a sudden you see why. And then the temple to Peter, back to the temple, and then in parables. So you have all of that in the first part of this section, and then the traps that they set. We're going to get back to some of this in a minute, but that here they are still trying to figure out a way to take him captive and do whatever they can get away with to him. And then you have the great commandments. I think we did seven lessons on this in Sistersville last year, on the great commandment and the one that's like unto it. And putting those in chronological order was one of the most interesting things that I've ever done as far as realizing how this subject came up. Here at the end of his life in Matthew 22 and Mark 12, it comes up. But Luke comes along, and in Luke 10, before this, it comes up, and it doesn't come up because Jesus said, this is the first and this is the second. It comes up because the lawyer asked him, and he said, how do you read? And the lawyer is the first person in the Bible that said, this is the first one and this is the second one. In the Old Testament, they're not even connected. The Old Testament, the second commandment is in Leviticus and is not called that, and the first commandment is years later in Deuteronomy, and it doesn't mention the other one, and they're separated by books and decades. And here this guy comes along, and Luke, and said, and Jesus said, you're right. So there's interpretation, correct interpretation, and then Jesus uses that himself here in Mark 12 and Matthew 22. And so I think that's a situation where, if you get the chronological thing and your references and put things in order, the timeline then has a tremendous impact on how we ought to see these. But again, Mark by itself gives us that information. Let's just go over here just for a little bit in the Mark 12 section. Because again, here is a situation where putting these together, they really do supplement one another. In Mark 12:28, one of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well, asked him, which commandment is the most important of all? Jesus answered, the most important is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. Well, in Deuteronomy, it doesn't have four, it has three. But if you study the words in Hebrew and Greek, you find out that each one of these words is basically comprehensive. Heart is the same as soul. Soul is the same as strength, and yet they're different. You know, they all encompass the whole deal. But then he says, the second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. And the scribe said to him, you are right, teacher, You have truly said that he is one and that there is no other besides him. Now you have this man not quoting the scripture, but paraphrasing it, and he's getting it, which is also very interesting, I think, and not in any other account. And to love him with all the heart, with all the understanding, which is not in the previous, but it's correct, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is much more than all whole burnt offerings. And that's not in it. That's, he brings that up. And that's right. Burnt offerings and sacrifices. When Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." So this is a much larger account than the Matthew 22 and the Luke 10, which is connected to when he said, "Who is my neighbor?" Remember that? And you had the prodigal son, or not the prodigal son, what is it? Good Samaritan. That grew out of this same discussion at a different time and place and people, but the same things are being talked about. And so you have that as an earlier event. Here's how it's brought up again, and here's another way to use. So that shows that you have these two things in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Well, how can I use that? Well, Matthew, Mark, and Luke show you can use it in a variety of ways. You don't have to use a verse the same way every time, because no verse has just one word in it. And so these two commandments are useful in all sorts of situations, and it isn't out of line at all to find out if the questioner, in one case, the person asking the question actually knows what he's talking about later on, which this guy does know. So anyway, that's just an illustration of how Mark provides us, and all three of these men do that, with information that the other ones don't. When they're talking about the same event, it really isn't the same record of it. Any questions or comments before we move a little further down here?
I understand you say you think he was asked this question two different times. Once by a scribe and once by a lawyer.
Yeah, the one in Luke 10 is earlier. Chronologically, it's a different setting. The one in Mark 12 and Matthew 22 is the same. It's like we're sitting here and two guys are reporting on the same event. It's the same situation. But in Luke 10, it's totally different. As a matter of fact, in Mark 12, I've already moved away from it. 38 or 28. What is it here? The scribe heard him disputing, and he asked which commandment is the most important, and Jesus answered and told him what the most important commandment was. Okay, so look over at Luke 10. It starts in 25. A lawyer stood up and put him to the test. Some people say that means he's trying to trap him. I don't believe that's what that's about. But he said, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said, "What do you read?" And the lawyer is the one who said, "The first commandment is." In the other case, Jesus said it. So you have a totally different setup. You get talking about the same two commandments, but it's a different setting and a different, totally backwards. If Helen said to me, "What's the greatest commandment?" And I say, "Well, how do you read?" And so she says, and then Helen says, "What's the greatest commandment?" And I just go ahead and answer it. See, one case, Jesus just answered. In the other case, he says, "Well, what are you reading? You know, what have you learned?" And it is different. So is that what you're asking?
That part of it. And yeah. I was also wondering, is there any evidence that was like a burning question of the day?
Well, that I don't know. I have heard, I went to the School of Preaching, you may have been there that day when I talked about this thing, and I said when I was doing this research about the fact that this lawyer got this right in Luke 10, I said, I don't know what they were thinking in that day. I don't know if they had a tradition, the first and second commandment or not. And I said, I didn't do this research on purpose because I didn't want to know. I just want to view it. And I'm not saying that I never want to know. I'm saying here, I just want to view it based upon being Theophilus, you know, and there's and having only a Bible. If all you have is the Bible, this is the first time it ever came up. Now, I do think that somebody commented, when you try not to listen, that it actually was sort of a traditional view, and I don't know if I could find evidence of that or not. I still haven't ever looked for it, but...
Luke's account makes me think of it. When you make an assignment and the student says, how long does it have to be?
Yeah.
Maybe the Pharisees were never thinking, what's the most important thing we have to do?
That's right. And they did. They did try to ignore a lot of things, as you well know. And what they ignored was the most important. But this guy in Luke 10 was, he couldn't have been more correct. And maybe, hopefully, he understood the implications of what that, you know, Jesus said in Matthew, everything hangs on this. Everything hangs on these two things. Imagine how strong those two things have to be for that to be so. And so here's another case where if we are going to become familiar with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as the thing we need to tell the world is Jesus, his life, and which ends in the resurrection and the Great Commission, so we're not leaving anything out, then this is one of those things where we can hone in on to people. You know, ask them that question. Go ahead.
You know, Skip, it also says that Jesus said what's written in the law.
Yes.
He didn't care about what was written in their tradition.
Which they had volumes and volumes, yeah. Didn't they? I mean, I...
So this guy knew the law. He quoted those laws out of Deuteronomy and out of
the Right.
And it's pretty neat.
And to have his quotation to be so well worded. I mean, he's not, paraphrasing is not wrong, but he just got it. And Leviticus 19:18 is quoted, I think, 8 times in the New Testament. That is really, and you read them all, find them all, you realize how much of the New Testament hangs on love your neighbor as yourself. And that's another part of that. But you could get to this part of the life of Jesus and go all kinds of places. You could say, well, let's see how Jesus did to love the Lord with all his heart, all his soul, all his mind, all his might. Let's just trace that. I mean, you could do that through all 4 books, just those 4 things. And your student, your friend, your kid, whoever it is going to be in a position to learn, you know, what's more important to learn than the life of Jesus as far as people. So anyway, that's some of the ways that I think this can be used. And if we get in our minds just a little bit of a structure, and the more of it you get, the more easy it is to know where to go in these books. Anything else? I want to go to the charts for a second. I wanted to do more than I'm going to do, but on the strength I saw in those who were sick, hurting, or grieving, this is in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that we're doing all of that, and that's from reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John once a week for about 4 months a few years ago, just to see what it would produce. It produced this and a lot of other things, but so that's common, and these are just a few illustrations. The next one says they really did want him dead, And I was going to, because Mark was so short, I thought we might have extra time and we would just read all of these verses as a class, but we can't. But when I was going through Mark today, putting the outline in my other Bible, I came to the chapter 9:30 and 31 and 10:32, and I realized I think there's a verse not in this list, and it isn't. It's 8:31 should be in there, and maybe some others, but the words that are used in reference to wanting Jesus dead here, not every time does it say that specifically, but that's what they're after. They're plotting, they're scheming, they're making every effort that they can think of to trap him, to arrest him, to do away with him, and to just stop all of this so that they would not have to listen to him and really live the way he told them that they ought to live. So one of the places here in Mark, I forget which one it is, but in Mark, early on, when they are trying to make a case against him, the Greek word for that is the word category. And that doesn't sound like making a case against somebody that the word category would fit. So I looked it up, and the Greek word for it is category, and it actually is compound, and it does have to do with making a case against somebody. So I looked up the English word, because I did this one other time, and the English word sounded so much like the Greek word, I thought they must, you know, be the same thing. Well, in this case, they weren't. You know, it had all the earmarks of being English and Greek are the same, and no, they weren't. Well, this one is. The Greek English word category is from this word, and it the movement from this word where they are making a case move to the making a case means having a bunch of information that's all alike, right? To make a case, your evidence needs to work in connection with itself, or it's contradictory, and so we get the category. That's where we get our word category, is from this making a group of things, putting a group of things together that point to that. So you have the Sears catalog divided into categories. Who doesn't remember that? You know, toys. So what do you expect in the toy category? You know, and all of it is that way. So that's where we get it. And that's what they were doing. And so if you think about that, if I could find that verse in a minute, I will, but my eyes are blurry right now. I'll use that excuse. But you think about that and apply that to what's happening from the beginning of Jesus' ministry to the end. The entire time, these guys were trying to come up with some set of things that made sense to use against him. And they never could find two. None, actually, that could be legitimately used. And even at his trial, they have to come up with witnesses, right? Plurality. And what did they find? Mark says they couldn't, their witnesses were false and they couldn't even agree with each other. They're not in the same category. Even the false witnesses couldn't make a story up that harmonized with itself. You know, and so I think that concept of how Mark, and this Greek word category is used in other places. It's not like that's the only place, but it is what it's talking about. And if you look at how, like this list here that we have, and read it through with that in mind, that's what, whoever these people were, that's what they wanted. They wanted to establish this by making all of these things make sense together. And in every case, he just exploded the argument, the accusation, and they were unable. And even when he's silent at his trial, just stand there and let them throw all this stuff out. And even the people putting him on trial said, "This guy's innocent." what are you doing? You know, what is this all about? Yeah, I mean, you can't, you're wasting my time with an, you know, category like of this. It just doesn't work. So I think that's, that since Mark uses that word fairly early on, is a way of grasping that thread, which is another, I mean, just that thread by itself would be one that you could take somebody through. And when we were first starting this, Ivan Stewart did a one-shot Bible study thing. And what you did is in the beginning of your Bible, you wrote whatever the first verse was, and then you would write, go to your that place in your Bible and write the next verse in the chain, and the next, and you took your student through 30 or 40 references that were already marked. You just go around, you know, and go through the whole chain. Well, the Thompson Chain Reference Bible has thousands of those chains, and this could be one. I mean, you could just trace with your friend through Mark by doing that same kind of thing and say, let's just look at the sum, at least, of the places where Jesus finds out that they're after him. And then the other one down there, the soul of Jesus, the two first two, Mark 1 and Mark 6, have the word compassion in it, which is not always the same word in the original, but there's a Greek word for compassion that has to do with the inner organs. And here is a transliteration of that word. S-P-L-A-G-C-H-N-I-Z-O-M-A-I. That's the verb. Now, you might have to ask a Greek person to pronounce that. Do you have any of these on your menu? I say splagidzomai, but there's a bunch of letters I didn't pronounce. And I don't know how you... It's kind of like growing up in Detroit with all the Polish names. There's a whole lot of names, word letters that they don't pronounce in their names, at least not in English. So, you know, they're just there. But this is a word that refers to deep-seated compassion, and Mark uses it there and in some other places. And then, of course, how will you respond to him? Now, in the last couple minutes, I want to do a couple other things, but I'm going to save it in case you have something you want to ask about or comment on before that, because this isn't the most important thing to do. It's just one of the things I have option to do. Anybody? You? Oh, go ahead.
What did you say the name of the book was?
Fourfold Gospel? Is that one? By J.W. McGarvey? And you have, that is actually, you can get it online more than one way. And there is an enhanced version of it that you can get for your Kindle for a couple dollars, or you can get a free one. There's one website you can go to, and if you just type it in, I think it pops up, where you can print it off, which is a lot better than buying one of the current editions, which is $27.95. Just print it off. And it's legal. As long as you don't tell anybody you did it. But it is a, and Brother McGarvey was a great Bible student, and the no, we're going to edit that out, and then we're going to edit that out, and now we're going to edit. This guy's going to have, what is he? But anyway, he really was good. Now I will say this about the chronology of the life of Christ. If you go to A.T. Robertson, who was a Baptist preacher, and he did a harmony of the gospel, same concept, they're not always identical. The chronology is just, they're just places where, okay, we're just going to have to say it looks like to me that this is the order of these events, and someone else is going to say it, maybe that's a little different order. So, to say that I know McGarvey's order is perfect, I can't do that. But he does harmonize similar or exactly if same events. If it is the same event, he puts them together, and they're in, you know, in that way you have the reading, and there's a code in there, an ABCD code, that you can tell whether you read which one you're reading when they are combined. And then it's got notes. It's a commentary in a lighter type, a lighter print. So it's really good. And there's an index to show you how to get to the places you want to get to, because it's not in this order. So if you want to find Mark 12:8, you go to the back and find it. But it's really, really a good book. Anyone else? Okay, what I want to do, and I've tried to do this at different times, is names and titles of Jesus or God or the Holy Spirit. But anyway, in Mark, names and titles, and there are some that are going to be repeated by other writers, and they are extremely important, but they're not necessarily the ones that they use the most. So obviously he's called Jesus Christ, the Son of God, Beloved Son, the Holy One of God by a demon, and others. But then in chapter 2, verse 10, and I don't know if this is a complete list now that I've made a mistake on a couple other things, but I think it is. He is called the Son of Man, that you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins in Mark 2:10. And all of a sudden you start seeing him called that, or calling himself Son of Man, which is real contrast to John, where he's called Son of God over and over again and never called the Son of Man. Well, I don't know that these writers said, here's why I did this, so I'm not trying to figure that out, but they did do it. So what can I get from it? In the Son of Man, connected with all of this human activity that Jesus was involved in, just helps me see the humanity of Jesus, and it emphasizes that. Son of God is intended by John to refer to the deity of Jesus, because he says that in John 20, 30 and 31, that he's writing that you might know this. And so you have that emphasis on the particular term, Son of Man. And if you want a list, we can maybe print it off for next week, or you can get this copy. I don't know if you can do that tonight or not, but it's one of the times that I wrote, and it's legible. So you might... But he has the power to forgive sins in 2:10. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath in 2:28. 8:31, the Son of Man must suffer many things, and so forth. Son of Man, Son of Man. Well, who else is Son of Man in the Bible? There is one other person that dominates the term in the Old Testament. One of the prophets. Huh? Ezekiel. Son of Man, a lot of times. So that is a little parallel, and you might look at Ezekiel and the humanity and the human interest stories that God calls him the Son of Man, and so there's a little tie-in. Not that Mark quotes Ezekiel, but at least there's a link in the terminology. And so Jesus does use that. And there'll be times when maybe in one account you'll see Son of God about a similar occasion, and another Son of Man, which isn't a contradiction. It could have been that both things were said. And it can also be a situation where the reporter is not required to give total quotation, but from his perspective, he is talking about the Son of God. And from his perspective, he's talking about the Son of Man. And you may use both terms, one by one writer, one by another. And so that Son of Man theme sticks out. And I don't know about this one, but these are in my notes that I did when I was reading through this some years ago to look at some of the threads. And I began to realize that when we're looking for the names and titles of God and Jesus, we're constantly looking at these exalted, profound terms. And then I began noticing in Mark how often Mark just refers to Jesus with the pronoun. He, you know. And so I decided I need to pay attention to that too and not just listen to proper names or terms, but to realize he is being referred to dozens of times without that. And so, and that becomes something else that can jump out at you. And so I have start with chapter 1, and I have samples of pronouns in chapter 1, and I never got to chapter 2 because I'm pretty sure it would take pages to do that. But then other times in Mark, he's called Jesus repeatedly, of course, the bridegroom, a teacher, son of the Most High God, son of David, shepherd, son of the blessed. And in chapter 1 and chapter 16, Jesus of Nazareth. So there are lots of those, and they're not all, most of them are not unique to Mark, but he does do that. And so when you see a given term referring to Jesus in a situation, you might just ask yourself, what is it about this situation that called for that term? And it may just, maybe not, but sometimes it does. You know, sometimes it is the very thing. In John, we'll see when Jesus said, "I am the light," he's not going to talk about sheep. He says, "I am," about a specific objective that he has in mind. And he says, "I am the good shepherd." He has a specific theme. So the names and titles of Jesus do have very important applications as far as that's concerned, and it pays us well to look at them. And we'll do, hopefully have time to do those, the I Am's in John, which I keep seeing people say there's 8 of them in John, and I'm thinking, no, there's more than a dozen. And I think that we'll try to get that as part of our study that week. So I'm just about done. I guess it's past 8 anyway. So anybody with the last minute comment or question? Okay.
Isn't Mark the only one who mentions the people thought he was calling for Ezekiel when he said Eli, Lama?
I'm not sure. He might be.
I wonder if he was just...
Yeah.
Interested in
yeah, right. It would be. It makes you wonder. That would be something to check. I'd have to look at that. Because you never know. It might be. And who knows what... I mean, there are things that slip by that we read. You know, people say, "Oh, I read it, and I never saw that before." Well, no. As short as these are, compared to other books like them, there's still a lot more than we'll ever grasp. Okay, well, we'll stop there, and then next time we'll pick up with Luke, and next week we'll just meet in the broom closet because we'll probably have a couple more dropouts.
I just thought nobody would go home and get out of this weather. That's
right. And you in the back there, I'm sorry, I didn't have a microphone.
One of the ones who was in the back, yes. I expected to see him.
No. I think I turned it off, I don't know. I wasn't told to. So. I don't even know what this is. Is this a phone? Wouldn't that be something you could use all your old time to record? Well, if you want to. All right. Go get yourself a treat.
Thank you. I got my
papers all out. I put them in a folder so that I can organize.
Wow. Super organized.
And lay my Bible on top of it. Pick my Bible up and let them take
all, man.
Well, here's your happy assignment.
I got Mark.
All right.
I'm just doing one of these. I did Matthew last week and Mark this week, so I thank you for movements. Well, thankfully, Mark was short.
Yeah.
And then Luke is longer than, he's even longer than Matthew, if you count the words.
Well, Wednesday night last week, he mentioned in class that, you know, you want to come read Matthew tomorrow. And so that's what I read it all in one day. And it was really enlightening to do it in one day. It just moves so fast. Mm-hmm. You just don't think about it moving so fast.
Well, I don't know if this is part of it or not, but we think of books and chapters.
Yeah. I got to read 28 chapters.
Yeah.
These are not books.
Yeah,
like, you know, not by any means. So they really are short.
For how much Mark is like Matthew.
Yeah.
Until I was, you know, I was kind of reading them back to back, and I'm thinking, am I even still
I know.
Because I really don't like this.
Yeah.
I mean, almost word for word.
That's right. It is. And it is. I guess a lot of this we'll just have to go to class in heaven and find out what some of the objectives were that were not important enough to tell us.
That's interesting.
But it is, it really is. And then Luke is just, he's really different, and a lot of it is very different because there's so much more in, you know, the first three chapters. Mostly it's not, well, more than that, but it's not anywhere. A lot of it's not anywhere else. So you've got a whole new look.
Can you see because he was a doctor, of that in his
some of the writing. Language he uses and in the training that he had to be able to be so meticulous about all those details.
Last night in Bible class, I was talking about Jesus talking about how hard it is for a rich man to go. Easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. Well,
yeah.
Have those people look up and say, well, that was a little door, only where one man had to screw, you know, a camel couldn't get through it. Well, I've read a lot of commentaries. I can't find that. And then, the thing about Luke was he uses a Greek word that means a needle,
surgeon.
A surgical needle. Yeah.
I don't think that's what you're talking about. I guess.